Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
Roll up, one and all to LNL, and we continue our summer series with a discussion about a fairly small topic, merely the origins of life and that nonsensical theory of evolution as it applies to intelligence. The session was recorded at this year's Adelaide Festival of Ideas in front of a highly evolved panel of experts and a terribly clever, genetically modified audience. The origins of life and the evolution of intelligence. How on earth did it happen? How did we get here? I don't mean to the Festival of Ideas, but into existence. We're going to look at aspects of this extraordinary mystery together this morning. I want to know what, if things had been different on the planet, if the environment had been slightly quirky or quirkier. Would life have developed using perhaps a different chemical formulation? At what point can we say that life first evolved? I looked at the Oliver Stone film last night at the hotel on George W. Bush, if you're with us or against us. Some people seem to think that life's like that. It's you're either alive or you aren't. But then it seems fairly clear that that's not the case, that life exists on some sort of continuum. And I want to find out from our distinguished panel when they think that life as such kicks in. I want to know when it was that what we call intelligence happened, and at what point did it morph into consciousness? Lots of other issues. Those of you who attended last night's opening do here will be familiar with the delightful Antonio Lascano, who's a biology professor at the National Independent University in Mexico, but he's very bee-like and he goes around cross-pollinating universities in France and Spain and Cuba, Switzerland, Russia and the USA. He verges on the promiscuous. He is the current president of the International Society for the Study of the Origin of Life, so may have something to offer this morning. John Mattick is one of us. He was born and raised in Steak and Kidney. He's the Professor of Molecular Biology and an Australian Research Council Federation Fellow. He's won oodles of prizes. His mantelpiece needs, a huge amount of bolstering to carry them. The Sara Eureka Prize for Leadership in Science, the inaugural Gutenberg Professorship at the University of Strasbourg in 2008. The Susan Miller comes to us from Edinburgh. She's now the big cheese next door at the South Australian Museum. And her co-panelists were marvelling at the fact backstage that she's a yachts person and a diver. She's a deep diver. She's also, I think she's the first person I've ever met who's one of these. I wrote it down somewhere, now I can't find it, but amongst, she's got some very arcane scientific credentials. While she's dabbling in the depths of water, Rachel Webster, who was also on stage last night, is more at home in the depths of space. Rachel is Professor of Astrophysics at the University of Melbourne and Chair of the National Committee of Astronomy. So I want to get her to talk in due course about not life on this rather ordinary little planet, but on summer, but the life she knows intimately in distant galaxies. In fact, she's going to reveal to us. She's made this discovery at some point this morning. I wonder if you'd start the ball rolling, please, by speculating on the nature of life from whatever vantage point you choose.
One thing that we know for sure is that as of today, there's only one planet in the universe that we can be sure there is life, which is ours.
Now, Rachel won't agree with you. But
The fact that this is the only planet that we know that has life doesn't mean that it's the only planet that has life in the universe. But so far, I think it's important to keep in mind that extraterrestrial life is a little bit like democracy. Everybody speaks about it, nobody has seen it so far. So that's something that we really should keep in mind. Secondly, we know that life is on Earth was not the outcome of a miracle or of a rare chance event, but rather of a process of evolution that we can somehow reconstruct, combining evidence from laboratory experiments and evidence from meteorites and trying to reconstruct the early Earth, at least theoretically. We also know that life appeared very quickly on Earth, and that suggests that it's perhaps not so difficult to have a planet full of living entities. But one point that always comes as a very strong blow against our anthropocentric views is that for for a very lengthy period of time, billions of years, the only form of life on Earth were microbes. The bacteria that we despise as pathogenic agents, the bacteria that we are so keen on destroying, washing our hands or brushing our teeth, were actually the dominant forms of life on Earth for billions of years. And they changed the planet in a way that makes it a very peculiar site in the solar system. We breathe oxygen and take it for granted, but this is the outcome of a co-evolution of the planet and bacteria that went on for a very lengthy periods of time. So I think we really have to put a little bit aside the Pasteur prejudice, the 19th century prejudice that all microbes are germs, to look at them not only as our ancestors, but also as a form of life that has the capacity of transforming an entire planet into a very peculiar place.
Are those little prerequisites for life in their billions building around the planet, are they alive themselves, fully alive?
No, I wouldn't take such a pantheistic view. I will say that to have a living entity, you need a number of physical and chemical preconditions, but that doesn't make them alive. Just like the wax in a beehive, that's how you call it, is part of the colony, but it's not alive in itself.
You come from Mexico, and you will have brought with you a number of very dangerous viruses.
Very likely. You want me to speak?
Is a virus fully alive?
No. I think that raises the issue of a good definition of life. And one thing that we can be for sure is that as of today, there's not one single property that we can assign as defining life. Viruses exhibit a property of life, which means, or a number of properties of living systems, like replication, or natural evolution, natural selection. But you can go to the chemist, to the pharmacy in the corner, you can buy half a kilogram of DNA, the DNA will replicate and it's not alive by itself. Or you can have RNA molecules that can evolve naturally under given pressures in the laboratory and they are alive by themselves. What is very peculiar of life is that it combines a number of different properties. And I'm not saying something of my own. I'm just quoting Oparin, who in 1924 was the first to say this, that what's very peculiar of living systems is that they are very complicated, complex systems we call them in scientific jargon. They are capable of undergoing natural selection. They replicate. And we try to emphasize nowadays the fact that they are chemical systems because you can have, in this way, you can avoid the discussion about artificial life when working with computers.
John, any opening statement before I interrogate you? Is there anything in general that you want to share with the audience?
Well, I think another definition of life, which I rather like, is that it's the antithesis of the second law of thermodynamics. It uses information and energy and raw materials to create order. And that's what life does. That's my first comment, Philip. The second is, Antonio's mentioned the long lag before the evolution of complex organisms, one of the great mysteries of biology, why it took so long to generate complex organisms, and the rise of oxygen tensions is certainly part of it. But it seems like biology, or evolution, I should say, discovered the power of digital communication and control systems a billion years before we did. It took them 3 billion years to get there. But in so doing, they set the platform for the emergence of developmentally complex organisms, and the emergence of intelligence, which is, clearly an eventual outcome of the natural selection process for reasons we may discuss.
Do you sense that this process is inevitable given the right sort of soupy mixture throughout Rachel's galaxies?
One of the great mysteries of biology is the emergence of the first self-replicating system, first cell, if you like. And that the geological, chemical evidence on this planet suggests that that occurred around 4 billion years ago, not that long after the planet had cooled enough for the oceans to condense. So virtually as soon as there was water on this planet, there was life, which raises two questions which go to the heart of your question. Was life seeded here on cometary material, as proposed by great British astronomer Fred Hoyle? Mm. It was always called Hoyle's Howler, but he understood that there was a question here. Or did it arise very quickly once the conditions were right? In other words, did it seed and take root once conditions were right from elsewhere in the galaxy, or did it self-assemble? And I don't think there's an answer to that question, but clearly it has occurred, and the only question is, well, how rare are the circumstances by which it can occur?
Hoyle, of course, was howled down and greeted with great ridicule, but he was no dummy. But I had a problem with his idea that life is spread around the universe in rather the same way that this gentleman spreads ideas around universities, because it still had to be kindled somewhere. So it shoves the question off the planet and puts it somewhere else. So did you ever find the Hoyle argument satisfying?
Well, I thought it was one of the two reasonable options. And I don't recall Hoyle having said whether it arose once or many times, which is the question. Do the conditions... I mean, there are more stars in the universe than there are grains of sand on the Earth. Just ponder that. Most of them were planets, or many of them were planets running around them. So how often it can occur is, at least at this stage, lost in the mists of time.
I'm glad you raised that image of the grains of sand. The first person to actually demonstrate it was Carl Sagan in Cosmos, and he scooped up a handful of sand, and he said there are about 10,000 grains in the average handful, and they're trickling down between his fingers, and he said there are more suns up there than grains of sand on Earth. And I remember just the mind being blown. Your mind was blown by that sort of thing, wasn't it, Rachel? It's not blown now, but it's in remarkably good order.
The big numbers are always impossible to comprehend, and I think you just deal with them for long enough and they just become part of the fabric.
Are you optimistic that, in fact, various sorts of critters are bounding around throughout the various cosmoses?
Do I think there's life out there? Look, as an astrophysicist, I think most of us actually believe there probably is, and it's just a probability argument. There's so many possible sites that surely it must arise somewhere else. And in fact, I would even extend Antonio's democratic argument and say, why should we be special? You know, it can probably arise anywhere.
You're listening to LNL on ABC Radio National Summer, abc.net.au/rn. I'm finally getting that right after years of practice. A discussion from this year's Adelaide Festival of Ideas on the origins of life and the evolution of intelligence. The panel: astrophysicist Rachel Webster, biologist Antonio Lascano, God, he was great, molecular biologist John Mattick, and geologist Suzanne Miller.
Now, Susan, I found the thing about you that I thought was enchanting. You are the very first person who is a metamorphic petrologist that I've ever met. A metamorphic petrologist. What the hell is that?
Oh, look, it just means that I look at rocks that are very old and have been buried very deep in the earth. It's a fancy way. It makes it sound very important.
So we could scrub this out and just say looks at rocks.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Isn't academia a wonderful place? Yes. Susan, when you were sort of swimming around in the primal ooze, have you had any special vision of the nature of life that has tantalised you?
Well, I suppose I love John's description or definition of life, because, of course, living systems have to take energy from their surroundings. And it's because of that interaction with the environment that means we have evidence of life throughout the history of the planet. It's not that we have the life itself, but we have their interactions, and particularly very early life, where you might not have had, where you wouldn't have had bones, for example, or skin that could have been preserved as fossil material. You're actually looking at the way in which those organisms interacted with their environment. And that, to me, is an extraordinary thing, that you're seeing a sort of trace, a footprint of the life, earliest life on Earth. And it's certainly, from a geological point of view, there's evidence here in Western Australia of life at 4 billion years, life in the Greenland rocks at 3.8. So it's, to me, it seems quite extraordinary that you can look at something that is 4 billion years old, and yet you can categorically say that there was life on Earth at that stage.
I often used to talk to Stephen Jay Gould, and he reminds us, going back to mega numbers, of all the billions and billions of life forms on this planet that didn't make it. In other words, the fecundity of life, once it becomes operational, is beyond prodigious. Now, does that not suggest that even if the world had had a different formulation, that even if the precursors to life had been behaved somewhat differently, that there's an that the universe seems to have an insatiable desire to see life happen, and that it might have happened slightly differently?
I would be reluctant to assign human desires to the universe.
Oh, go on.
I can see the metaphor, and I appreciate the metaphor, but yes, I mean, the universe does have the conditions for brewing life in more than one sense. For instance, just to support what my colleagues here have said, if you look at meteorites, some classes of meteorites, one peculiar meteorite that actually fell in Australia in 1969, the Murchison meteorite, and I will speak about that tomorrow, is full of chemicals. They are exactly the same that you find in living beings, amino acids, purines, pyrimidines, sugar derivatives like that can be easily explained as the composition products of ribose and the exoribose, which are the sugars that we find in nucleic acids. So yes, the chemistry in the universe seems to be conducted to the compounds that can lead to life. But it's also true that there were probably many blind alleys on the evolution of these compounds. So not necessarily the synthesis of organic molecules will lead to living organisms. And we have very good examples of that in the case of Jupiter or the moons of Saturn, where you have a very complicated chemistry going on, but clearly the conditions preclude any form of life there.
Rachel, almost every other day, people in your calling, people who fiddle around with cosmology, who work at NASA, seem to be looking first and foremost for water. They say, if there's water, ipso facto, it's going to happen. Do you share that view, that water is the prerequisite?
I probably would hesitate to say it's an absolute prerequisite, but certainly if it's there, there's a very, very strong case for fostering the development of life. And the reason for this is quite simple. The radiation that comes from any star, like our sun, has got quite high energy photons. We all know about these. UV photons, you know, cause quite a lot of damage to our skin. But they're also, it's pretty damaging to, you know, those little bacteria that want to form as well. And so what you need to do is to have some way of protecting those early life forms so that they've got a chance to develop and evolve. And the very best way to do that is water. And water provides an environment for them to live in and exchange chemicals and do all those things they need to do, but it also protects from those harmful rays from the star that's presumably driving the life form. So that's why we're quite fixated on water. We know that it's a very, very effective cocoon, if you like, in which to develop life.
Suzanne, with your background, you have to be fixated on water. Do you have a view about its all importance?
Well, I think certainly from the point of view of evolution of life on Earth, it was clearly incredibly important. The rocks in which we find those very early evidence of life were laid down in water. So the inference is that you have life developing in water. And of course, the structure of the Earth created a perfect environment for water to be held on the surface, for an atmosphere to form over time. And it was only there because you had that structure. You have an iron-rich core, which allows us to have a gravitational field, which allows us to retain an atmosphere and hydrosphere. And so that was critical, the sort of geological prerequisite was critical to then retaining the conditions in which life, certainly on Earth, clearly developed. There's evidence of other rock types on Earth, on that very early Earth, volcanic rocks and so on, but the signs of life are all found in the sedimentary rocks which were laid down in water.
As a professional rock prodder, you would be aware that there's a lot of disputation amongst your colleagues about whether that fossil record something which can be said to be alive versus that one. It's clearly fuzzy.
Well, it's an extremely fuzzy area because, as I said before, you're looking at the evidence of life. You're not really looking at remains, but there's undoubtedly a lot of chemical evidence. The evidence that you see in these extremely old rocks is evidence of a chemical reaction, photosynthesis having taken place. We can look at the carbon isotopes in those rocks, and they very clearly have a signature, have a fingerprint of life, of some kind of photosynthetic life at that time. What the actual organisms were is a massive debate, and I think that's where there's more cause for differences of opinion amongst professionals as to what the life actually constituted and as to what the organisms were themselves, as opposed to there having been life.
Rachel, your new telescope is, of course, looking for the face of God, but failing that, will it give us a hint as to whether or not life exists elsewhere? I'm not talking about SETI stuff. I'm not talking about Carl Sagan and the boys listening. I'm wondering whether the images that you're able to extract from deep space will hint at the possibility or probability of life.
The telescope you're referring to, which is the SKA, in fact won't be probably directly tracing those sort of experiments, but there are astronomy experiments that are very, very focused on looking for evidence of life. And what has really happened in the last 10 years or so, is that astronomers have walked into this space taking a very big and global picture, sort of saying, essentially if I look at a planet or a star, what should I expect to see if there's life there? And so it's the sort of global perspective that we've taken. And the signatures that we're alighting on, there are some quite speculative ones, but the conservative ones are things where we see a system which is not in equilibrium. And because it's not in equilibrium, we understand that something has to be driving it out of equilibrium. And the thing...
What do you mean by equilibrium?
Okay. Equilibrium in a physical... And I apologise for... equilibrium in a system is where you just allow a system to sit and evolve until it gets to a state where the global properties don't change any longer. So, the temperature might become constant, the density might become constant, and so on. A gas might mix until it's uniform. So the example I'm going to give is that in an atmosphere, in our atmosphere on Earth, for example, oxygen is quite a dominant component. If we were to remove life from the planet of our Earth today, then that oxygen would probably disappear from our atmosphere on a timescale of a few thousand years. Because
really?
Oxygen is highly reactive, and it will just react with absolutely anything, and so it will disappear. Okay, and so we have an atmosphere which is a long way out of chemical equilibrium, as we would understand it. So it's life that is driving it to that state. And so what we would look for as astronomers would be some signature, and oxygen's a perfect one, but there may be others, that tells us that something is driving the system away from that natural equilibrium point. And this is in every sense an expression, as we've already heard from John, of the second law of thermodynamics, which is the scariest law in all of physics, let me just say. But what it says is that life locally creates order, but of course the flip side of it is that in a more widespread way it creates disorder, which is something that you may well appreciate.
It's interesting, I guess, that to wonder if we were being surveilled from a great distance by one of these telescopes, whether the current lack of order on Earth would be recognisable.
Absolutely.
So it would be.
Absolutely.
Your work in climate change may be being observed by a
well, obviously an inferior life form, from another galaxy. In other words, the instability would be noticeable.
Yeah, and I mean, in fact, a lot of our work is concentrating at the moment on trying to imagine what Earth looks like from somewhere else. I'll give you a beautiful story, because this is a graduate student of ours at Melbourne University, and you may have seen the reports in the press in the last few weeks, but she discovered Africa. And this is, everybody has sort of teased her about this, but the way she discovered Africa is actually extremely interesting, because what she was looking for was the reflection of light off the Earth. So this is sunlight off the Earth, and of course you can't see that if you're on the Earth. So what she had to do was to look at the dark side of the moon. And so the light reflects off the Earth and goes to the dark side of the moon. And then it depends which bit of the Earth that you're reflecting off, whether you're reflecting off the oceans or the land, you'll see something different. And that difference, if you can see that difference, if you can see going from ocean to land, then you know that you may have water, and water, of course, is the signature of life. Anyway, the long and short of it is she saw the reflection going from the Indian Ocean across to the land in Africa, and she discovered Africa. So there you go. You can still do that in 2009.
Yep, it's LNL from the 2009 Adelaide Festival of Ideas, a search for the origins of life and the evolution of intelligence. It's part of our summer highlights. And joining me on the podium were Antonio Lascano, biology professor at the National Independent University in Mexico City, a real star at the festival, Rachel Webster, professor of astrophysics at the University of Melbourne, Suzanne Miller, director of the South Australian Museum, and John Mattick, professor of molecular biology at the University of Queensland. All that brain power. John, may there soon emerge other forms of life, of consciousness, and I'm thinking of the possibilities of artificial intelligence as opposed to our form. In other words, at what point do you think it will become indisputable that we have set loose on this planet, at least, a new sort of life, which may in fact become quite influential?
I'm not sure at what point it will happen. I'm pretty confident that it will happen. If you think about the evolution of intelligence to begin with, just because I think reflecting on how we got to this point speaks to how what might happen next. I said in my talk earlier this morning that, and this has been a matter of some debate between Gould and other intellectuals in this area like Dawkins and Dennett, about whether intelligence was a one-off in the human population or whether it was an eventual outcome of evolution. And I'm firmly in the latter camp. If you think about evolution, the way that you get to complexity, it's clearly an advantage to evolve greater physical and physiological capabilities, you know, longer legs, teeth, whatever. But it's also an advantage, and I would suggest a greater advantage in the fullness of time, to evolve information processing capability, so that you not only can adapt to your environment in a physical sense, but you can respond to it in a dynamic sense. So the ability to absorb information from the environment through sensory systems and then act on that information is a very, very powerful advantage and subject to natural selection.
It's one of the definitions of intelligence, isn't it?
That's right. Mm. But you can track a path all the way back to E. coli, a simple bacterium that has a protein that can smell nutrients, activate its flagellar motor like a propeller prop to swim towards the nutrients. And that is an enormous advantage over an E. coli that does not have that capability because that one can access the food. Fast forward to humans with optical and oral systems and the evolution of information processing systems at cellular level, neuronal systems, and you have a brain. So unlike Gould, who said that it was one-off, I think that this evolution will always select for information processing capability, and sooner or later, in a highly contingent way, probably dependent on dexterity, among other things, because, for example, dolphins, they're smart enough, but they can't make tools and they can't make weapons, which are the two things that really accelerate your success if you're in a competitive environment, weapons in particular. And not many people think about how that has influenced human evolution. But so it'll come automatically. And then you get to a brain that's capable of interpreting or trying to interpret the natural world and building on this, building computers. And, you know, intelligence obeys you have to believe this, and I'm not big on belief systems, but it obeys the laws of physics and chemistry, and that sooner or later we will get to a point where we can create an entity that has enough information processing capacity to do so. However, the challenges are enormous, not just in computational terms. And it may be that you have to go to organic chemistry to get past silicon and metal to achieve this. Yeah. But you also have to have sensory input. I mean, a computer, what it lacks, and we have, I mean, is sensory input.
That was Hal's problem, wasn't it, in the Space Odyssey? Yes. He had to get his sensory input from frail human beings. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. So, and so the keyboard. So there are a lot of conceptual things that people aren't really thinking about, I don't think, at the moment. Well, some are, obviously, but in terms of really how you get a dynamically adaptable intelligence that can respond and influence its environment.
What have you ever speculated, Antonio, on where intelligence might end up, whether through evolution of us or other species or through artificial intelligence and a new life form of driven by some form of computer? Do you extrapolate?
I tend to shy away from those things for a very simple reason. I think I can self-describe myself as an evolutionist, and evolutionists are like one bird, that hypothetical bird that Jorge Luis Borges brought about, the so-called Gophers bird, that when it flies, it looks backwards and not forwards because he wants to know where he comes from and not where he's going to. So I tend not to think about the future of evolution, but one thing that is sure is that when we speak about intelligence in the human species, it's clear that it's also collective intelligence. And one normally assigns the idea of intelligence to one single entity, one single person, Mozart, Einstein, Galileo, whomever you want. But it's clearly the entire society, the social group that promotes the development of that intelligence in one way or the other one, which raises a different issue for me, namely, how do you create social environments that will allow everyone to expand his or her intellectual abilities to their uttermost? But one thing that I'm always very keen about is what happened during the evolution of eukaryotes, during the evolution of cells that have nuclei like our own, when there was a turning point in which we animals separated from fungi. I hate to say this, especially if there are any vegetarians in the hall, but the closest thing to an animal is a fungi. Mm. So if you go and have mushrooms instead of having some veal or some mutton, you're having the closest thing you can have to meat. Now, having said that, what's very peculiar is that you look at the phylogeny, you look at all the molecular evidence that we have, and it's clear that our sister group to animals are the fungi. Now, what happened during evolution that in the case of fungi did not lead to tissues, and in the case of animals did lead to tissues that can become a liver, a muscle, or neurons? And I think it's a fascinating stage in the evolution of the biosphere, that one thing went one way and the other thing went the other.
Critical difference is motility. Motility.
Yes, fungi don't have,
Once you can move, then there's a selective advantage to being able to develop systems for movement and
I've got bad news. At my farm, mushrooms race around the paddocks.
You've been eating the wrong ones.
Very alarming, yes. That's true, it's after I eat it. A certain amount of fungus. Have you thought about the where intelligence might end up, Suzanne? I mean, when you're not looking at rocks.
Well, I'm afraid I have to fall into the same camp as Antonio in that I'm probably even worse in that I like the certainty of looking into the past and evidence-based. And I think that's a natural human reaction. We're all very uncomfortable with uncertainty. And that's why it's quite demanding on us to think about where we might be going, where intelligence might be going. I mean, my hope would be that a sort of collective consciousness would create a more moral society, a society which can enjoy enlightenment and moving forward in that way in terms of evolving as a society rather than as individuals. But that's very much a, you know, blue skies kind of thinking. I shy away very much from the detail of how we might get there and why we might get there. I would hope that there's a selective advantage in getting there, but it's something that I'm much more comfortable looking backwards and looking at rocks and evidence than speculating on where we might be going. It's a very uncomfortable place to be.
Rachel, you are a professional speculator because cosmology does require these immense sort of intellectual leaps into the, well, not into the dark, into dark matter perhaps. Do you play with these ideas?
At some levels. One aspect I'd like to bring into the conversation is, you know, we've talked about intelligence, but there are other, you know, human or animal traits that are actually quite important in this evolutionary process, I think. And the one that I'd like to bring out is aggression, because, you know, aggression has in fact driven a lot of human activity. You could say it's why they got in a boat and went and discovered America, you know. It's why we go to the moon. You know, in many ways, this is driven by aggression. Now, of course, aggression can be very creative and positive to a certain point, and then you can tip over and it can be quite counterproductive. And we see that, obviously, in a lot of human interaction. And it's this interesting tension, I think, between our intelligence and the aggression that we also quite clearly have, that I think will determine, you know, how we evolve. And it's, I guess it's unclear to me which way it's going to go.
But you would acknowledge a point that Peter Singer and quite a lot of evolutionary scholars point out, that yes, while we are hardwired for aggression, we're also hardwired, it would seem, for cooperation. And it depends, you know, the scale on which you're looking. I mean, aggression worked wonderfully to maintain a tribe against others. But empathy then kicks in, and we've now got this interesting battle between violence and empathy.
Well, I think we're at a just fascinating time in human history right now, because I think we've actually reached a point where the big questions that we actually have to look at are a very fine balance between these things, and I don't think we can finesse it anymore. And, you know, I actually think that climate change is a perfect example of this. Our intelligence drives us to one understanding of what's going on. But, you know, our aggressive instincts to drive a bigger car, or, you know, you can frame it in any way you like,
to be a denialist, yes,
is actually preventing us from doing what rationally we know we need to do. So I think we have in this a very interesting time to see whether cooperation, in fact, is going to win out.
Well, let's go back to you on this, Suzanne, and let's look at climate change. Do you fear that that's evidence that our much-vaunted intelligence is insufficient to save us?
No, I don't. I think it's not about intelligence. I mean, there's been climate change throughout geological history. The planet is constantly in flux, and I think that's something that life has had a major influence on, and actually has been the causal effect of a lot of those changes throughout the history of the planet. We know that there are certain things that we do that have a particular effect, and that may be to increase CO2 levels in the atmosphere. We actually don't know what that anthropogenic effect is going to be. We can speculate and we can model, and a lot of the models now, they're fairly short-term though. I mean, as somebody who likes to work in billions and millions of years, a model that looks at something over 50 years is a very short, it's a very short period of time. But we do know that the models that the evidence that we're seeing now are matching the models that have been developed. What we don't know is what that effect will be, and the capacity of the Earth to go into different feedbacks, whether they're negative or positive feedbacks, to allow the Earth to come back more into balance. But we do know we are having an effect, so we do have a moral obligation to look at what we are doing and work cooperatively. But I think your point about aggression is really interesting, because there's also that issue of, well, why should I do it? That, you know, if India and China are going to undoubtedly increase their amount of CO2 emissions, you know, if I drive a smaller car, that's not going to have any effect whatsoever. And it's almost more a mindset issue about the cooperative nature of the planet, which is an enormous leap from where we are and where we've ever been.
Could I just add to that? One of the unstated issues in climate change politics is equity. I mean, the Chinese or Indian view might be to say, well, if we're going to produce CO2, let's all agree on a standard CO2 emission per person on the planet, which means you have to come down, but we'll go up. And that's the unstated conversation, is really what the global equity in terms of power generation and usage is.
We've chucked away the rest. You're listening to the best of LNL on ABC Radio National Summer. My panel guests at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas were John Mattick, molecular biologist, Suzanne Miller, geologist, Rachel Webster, astrophysicist, and Antonio Lascano, biologist and all-round charmer. Okay, I'd like to introduce a completely different word into this discussion on life, and the word is death. It's always seemed to me that the curse, the triumph and the curse of the human intelligence is that we became aware of our own mortality. Once that kicks in, we ask some very big questions, we create religions, and I think also the consciousness of death also drives, to a large extent, our art, our science. It builds our pyramids. It creates the impetus to beat death, which, of course, we've never been able to do, or at least thus far. Scientifically, is death interesting to you as life? In other words, even we say it's hard to know where life begins, it's often pretty hard to know where death begins.
Well, yes and no. yes and no, because bacteria are potentially immortal. Mm. You can crush a bacteria, or you can boil the bacteria, or you can add some antibiotics, and that's it, they're gone. But the type of cells that have in their inner wiring the program for dying eventually are eukaryotes. Now, eukaryotes are a very peculiar type of cells. Most of our friends or relatives are eukaryotes, for sure. But what distinguishes us from prokaryotes, from bacteria, to put it generally, are the fact that not only we have nuclei, but also that we are the outcome of a very peculiar process of evolution, which is symbiosis. We normally have a very cartoon picture of what Darwin say in the sense of competition, but the fact is that you also have cooperation in biology, and I don't want to assign any moral meaning to the word. It's just something that you observe. Bacteria can get inside other organisms, and there you have a completely different type of cells, and that's what actually led to the type of cells that we have. I don't know if anybody has explored in detail how the appearance of eukaryotes led to the emergence of program death. But for sure, as old as eukaryotes, which means probably around 2.5 billion years, that became something that the biosphere had to cope with, apart from the incidents and the accidents of that could put an end to prokaryotes, to bacteria. Mm-hmm.
You look at death a lot in the form of in the fossil record. Clearly, death is a part of the whole process. It's got to get out. Life's got to get out of the way to allow room for the next part of the process. Do you think about death personally? Is your sense of mortality intensified by your science?
I don't think it's intensified by the science. I think there's a I guess the feeling of death, or the impending sense of death at some point, is one of our reasons why we're driven to procreate, to have children, so that in some sense your genetic material lives on. And I think that's where science has provided a lot of comfort to people, where as religion has decreased perhaps in society, that has given a sense that your spirit lives on, that your genes live on, that your genetic
your
material
lives on. That's Sorry? A bit of a reach, isn't it?
Sorry?
You're arguing that your spirit lives on in this.
Well, I think that when you... I'm talking entirely as from the viewpoint of being a relatively new mother, that you try and imbue in your children a sense of what you feel is right, a sense of being kind to others, a sense of living your life in a way that will not cause hurt or anger or aggression. And I think that in that sense, you can imbue your children with your own sense of values. And that provides a sense of life after death, I suppose.
Rachel, in a way, cosmology and the great series Cosmos by Sagan, which I recently revisited and looked at again, it really held up pretty well, apart from being overproduced and
and a bit vainglorious in some ways. But I would have thought that your perception of life, of individual life, must be diminished by the magnitude of what you see through the telescope.
Perhaps in some ways, but, you know, we're still human, I've got to say. So, you know, we're...
Speak for yourself, right?
We're as locked in as the rest of us. Look, the thing I was just going to add in, and this is a very bizarre thought that I have had, but, you know, obviously when you die, you know, your body, you know, ashes to ashes, you know, the carbon atoms continue on with a life of their own and so on. So your physical, the physical elements of your body retain little memory that you were there. But there's this, within your brain is a set of information which is peculiarly your own, you know, your own experiences, your own knowledge, your thoughts and so on. And as far as I can establish, that does not live on in any way that we can codify it at this point in time. You know, it sort of disappears. And yet in some sense that we understand, it's quite real information. And I must confess, I have wondered whether it is possible in terms of where we're evolving, and John may have some thoughts on this, whether it is possible to essentially data dump, you know, the information, the images, you know, the recordings.
I've downloaded myself.
Anyway.
There's a very famous director of a research institute in Melbourne, and not the one that might immediately spring to mind, who once said, if it ain't published, it ain't been done. So what gets published, it puts in the record, in books, is the living memory of the brain. Mm.
Yeah.
But that's a very small subset of what's there.
That's right.
Yes. And maybe the newer media, whether even, God forgive us, you know, blogs and Twitter will have some of the more trivial elements of our brain's activity preserved for whoever wants to...
Okay, born into the Catholic culture, I want you to talk now about death, about scientific death, personal death, as a part of a discussion on life.
Perfect, because my point is that death is the price of sex. Which fits very much with the Catholic tradition.
Now you tell me. I would have chosen celibacy if I could have a couple hundred more years.
Death is the price of sex.
Oh dear.
And sex was selected by evolution because it allowed us to experiment with our genetic material in a way that a haploid organism with only one copy of the genome cannot. Because you may or may not be aware, but we have, well, most of you are, that we have two copies of our genome, and we can tolerate certain variations, sometimes called mutations in our DNA, which can be negative. And we can play in a way in evolutionary space in a way that organisms that only have one copy of the genes can't, because that negative impact is felt immediately. So sex is a way of exchanging information. But when you exchange information, you generate a new organism that hopefully has some value over the old one. The bacteria can live on because they can exchange DNA by themselves. So the evolution says, okay, well, there's an advantage to us in being able to exchange information in this way, but we've got to get the old out of the way. So we create sex, and we instantly have to have death at the same time.
And, of course, if you're Roman Catholics, you also invent them, or push the notion of celibacy, don't we?
those who are celibate push that notion. Most of us escape it.
When John was mentioning this co-invention of sex and death, what came into my mind is, I have to say it in French to be polite. In French, you say la petite morte.
The little death.
Voilà.
Yeah, yeah. I see.
But
you are a naughty Mexican, aren't you?
No, but there's something I want to say, actually, when you raise the issue about this feeling of individual death. I'm probably not only the only Mexican in the audience, in the hall. I'm probably the only person that died twice.
Right,
20 years ago, I actually had peritonitis, and it was misdiagnosed, and I ended up in the intensive care unit, and because I was severely ill, I actually died twice and was caught just at the very last moment. And never ever came into my mind the idea, reflecting on it or at the time, never came into my mind the idea of this is it or what will I live beyond me. No, no.
He wasn't a figure beckoning you through, through a gate. You didn't have an NDE.
No, the only thing I remember was very hot, which probably indicated that I was heading straight down to hell. But otherwise, I don't recall any other thing.
I had a very strange friendship with a person recently deceased called Kerry Packer, who was Australia's richest man. And I used to love pointing out to him that his life expectancy, at best, the total number of hours he would live, 700,000, so he wasn't even a millionaire in hours when he was $6 billion rich. Now Kerry kicked the bucket. He was playing polo and he died on the polo field, and many of us think it was a bad mistake to revive him, but he was revived, and he rang me up and he said, "Son, there's nothing over there. When you're dead, you're bloody dead." And then there's a pause and he says, "There's no one there to judge you, so you can do what you bloody well like." And Robin Williams, my distinguished colleague at Radio National, also died and was revived by another Radio National colleague in the science unit. He also had no fear, but no sense of anything nice about to happen. Yeah. But I'm astonished by some of the great minds in Australia. Manning Clark comes to mind. I interviewed Manning Clark, who was a great historian, shortly before he died. And with all his wisdom, he's told me, quote, "I have a shy hope of an afterlife." It's still an incredible emotional need, isn't it, for so many people.
In the arts and in the sciences, Macfarlane Burnett, Nobel Prize winner, said, perhaps more eloquently than Kerry Packer, that life after death is a biological absurdity.
Well, I've always felt that innately since I was a child, and yet the dread of death is one of the great motivators, one of the great energizers for human activity. I'm wondering how we'd behave if we even lived another 400 or 500 years. Would that take the tension, the creativity, the urgency out of the way we behave? Would it make us less violent? And we may have to face this prospect. We may, in fact, be on the edge of living much, much, much longer, climate change permitting.
I think the biologists are much better placed to understand whether we're going to live for 400 or 500 years, because I think the limitations are biological as far as I understand it. There seems to be a cycle within the cells that naturally, pegs out at about 100 years.
So we're not going to live 400 or 500 years, mate.
We could change that programming in principle.
Could we? Okay. Yeah. Is it too late?
I suspect so.
Oh dear. Yeah. I think it's been terrific. We've had a brilliant panel, and it's been a pleasure and a privilege to sit up here between you. And thank you very much for coming. Ladies and gentlemen. That discussion on the origins of life and the evolution of intelligence was recorded at this year's Adelaide Festival of Ideas. The guests were Antonio Lascano, biology professor at the National Independent University in Mexico City, Rachel Webster, professor of astrophysics at the University of Melbourne, Suzanne Miller, director of the South Australian Museum, and John Mattick, professor of molecular biology at the University of Queensland, a very daunting group. The questions from our highly informed audience went on for another 30 minutes. We couldn't fit them into the radio broadcast, but if you subscribe to our podcast, you can go to our website and you can download the program, including the banter and the questions. You've been listening to ABC Radio National Summer, one of the highlights from this year's LNL programs. On our next, you can hear again a discussion from last August with two of Australia's most respected military and strategic thinkers, Robert O'Neill and David Kilcullen. The news is next. See you later.